Hello out there, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to another great episode of Movie Geeks United. This evening, we're going to review the latest Blu-ray releases with our good buddy Adam Long. But first, the big piece of news that occurred earlier this week is the passing of Mike Nichols, truly one of our legendary directors. And we wanted to spend a substantial amount of time during this show to address his passing and what his legacy of work means to the world of film. Before we get to the Blu-ray releases. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hey.
So Mike Nichols, 83 years old. You know, we had just posted on our Facebook page, it was the anniversary of Karen Silkwood's death/murder. Mm-hmm. And so I had posted something about that the other week. And then I'd been reading stuff about actors talking about working with Mike Nichols, and then he passes. I mean, he was always present in the movie scene as one of our great versatile filmmakers, and also mm-hmm. his contribution to the stage, of course. But when you guys think Mike Nichols, what are the first movies or images that come to you?
Well, I mean, I think obviously The Graduate and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Those are obviously the two.
Yeah,
and I would throw in, for me personally, I would throw in Carnal Knowledge. Carnal Knowledge.
But it's not just that. You really, if you look at the whole resume, look at the whole, just the cinematic, not the TV stuff is incredible too, though. That's the funny thing. The TV stuff is groundbreaking within itself, Angels in American Wit. But if you look at the whole filmography, even the lesser stuff, and I think the lesser stuff is only, there's really Primary Colors and What Planet Are You From?
Primary Colors is not a lesser movie. That's a great movie.
I would throw
in lesser, like, to be something like Wolf or something. But
I would put in Wolf maybe, but I think
or the
Wolf has gotten better.
Primary
Colors just doesn't work as well as it should. But I still think it's a lesser movie. And I also think that the only one that's truly lesser is What Planet Are You From? I mean, that's the only one I can really come out and say that. It's funny, but it's not, you know, you watch it, you're like, yeah, haha. But that's...
You know, I watched it this year because our friend Jason Miller really likes it. And I was not as put off by that movie as I guess everybody else was.
I thought
it had some interesting things in it.
I think the key to that movie is Linda Tarantino. You take her out,
yeah.
But you don't have a
well,
movie.
The big problem with that, with What Planet is, it's just not as funny as you wish it would was.
Yeah,
you know, that's the problem.
That's true. But you know, you bring up Wolf and everything. It's the stuff with Jack Nicholson that's really, his contributions with Jack Nicholson Heartburn, I think, is a superb movie. I also think that Carnal Knowledge is the first movie I ever saw with Jack Nicholson.
This is my question. This is my question about Mike Nichols, in terms of Carnal Knowledge, because this is fascinating to me. How do you think? Because I love Carnal Knowledge, and I also love Closer. And
mm-hmm.
here he is examining kind of sexual politics, but a generation apart. And do you think that makes for a great double feature? And what do you think he reveals differently between those two generations?
Mm.
That's a good question, and I saw that when you posted that. I would have to, in some ways are the same movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could say that Clive Owen has the Jack Nicholson part, and Jude Law has the Art Garfunkel part. I mean,
I think they're two alike. Like that's, I wouldn't want to see a double feature of those two movies. It'd be interesting in sort of like a filmic or film study sort of way, but like as a viewer, you would be just comparing the two too much. And I don't think that Closer says anything deeper than Carnal Knowledge did. And I'm not.
Well, I don't think it does either. But
I didn't recognize anything different about it, really. Like
if it does say the same thing, then that's actually saying something. If
mm-hmm.
sexual politics has not changed in these 40
yeah.
years, then that
yeah.
that could be the point
but
of what he. Yeah.
I want to bring up something though. He did. You know, in 1988, he made Biloxi Blues, which is probably, I think, the best of Neil Simon adaptation there is, if you want to know the honest truth. And then he does Working Girl. And let's be, you know, Working Girl, I think, actually contains one of Harrison Ford's best performances. I won't lie to you. I think he's wonderful in that movie. And it's certainly Melanie Griffith's one of her best performances. And that's a really smart movie and a very funny movie. And he does these two movies in the same year, and they're just, you know.
Well, look, he was great at casting, and he was great at casting and kind of forming a different feeling about an actor in his casting. And let's be frank. I mean, if you want to look at the actors that we all love from the 70s, the quote-unquote non-leading man that actually became the leading man at the time, the outside-the-box leading man, you have Mike Nichols to thank for that, because he's the one that cast Dustin Hoffman in the Robert Redford role in The Graduate. I mean, it was written for a Robert Redford type. That was how it was kind of imagined. And he had the balls to say, no, I want Dustin Hoffman. That changed a lot. It really did in 68. What was it, 68 or 60? Yeah.
67.
And actors adored him. I mean, actors just loved him.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely correct. You know, like the 70s would not – look, the guy – with those two movies, with Virginia Woolf and The Graduate, he changed cinema, really, basically. He changed the direction of cinema. It was already sort of veering towards those more, you know, open kind of thing, but he's the one that really cracked it open. And the fact that he was, you know, totally embraced by Hollywood for doing that, you know, I mean, Virginia Woolf got 13 Academy Award nominations. The Graduate got 10 and won him his only Best Director Oscar. So, I mean, you know, I mean, so it was obvious that Hollywood was ready to go that way and I mean, he was the one who did it. And, I mean, it's just there's no other way to say it, America.
Yeah, I want to say this, though. His last movie that he directed, his last feature film, Charlie Wilson's War, was very good. It doesn't get the credit it deserves. But
no, it's good.
It's a superb film. It also contains, I mean, a very funny Philip Seymour Hoffman performance, but all, a great Tom Hanks performance, and it's a very good
Everybody's
movie.
Good in it.
Everyone is superb, and it's, you know, people don't talk about it, but you really think, wow, you know, everyone is, you know, last year we were talking about, a year ago, you know, we were talking about how, you know, Martin Scorsese has lost none of his vigor with Wolf of Wall Street. You could have said the same thing about Charlie Wilson's War with Mike Nichols. He's lost nothing. There is nothing there that's, you know, that's not as sharp as it was in something as brilliant and underrated as Catch-22. And let's face it, Catch-22 is a very good adaptation of a very funny, if not difficult, book.
I love Catch-22 as well.
I remember
it's
reading
superb.
About Catch-22 in the Biskind book, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, and Mike Nichols, actually, I mean, they had a lot of hopes on Catch-22. And their thunder was kind of swiped by MASH. And Nichols actually watched MASH in the theater, and he knew. He was like, we thought we were doing something groundbreaking, but then look at this. Look at MASH. And, oh, my God. And apparently Altman, good-naturedly, because I think everyone liked Mike Nichols. I think the only person that doesn't like Mike Nichols is Bill Clinton. That's what Mike Nichols said, that Bill Clinton's the only person that he knows of that doesn't like him. But Altman even had a poster in his office that said Caught 22 when he released MASH.
And that's a good. I didn't see Catch 22 until I guess in my 20s after reading the book, and it's a really good film.
Let me stop you. Can I ask you this? How is it in comparison with the book? I mean, because a lot of people who I know who have read the book don't really care for the movie. But why would that be? Like, why?
Well,
why
because
would you...
I think it's a hard thing to adapt, and they may not have. I can see why you wouldn't like the book. It's, I mean, I guess the closest thing, the analogy you can make is probably that Thomas Pynchon with Gravity's Rainbow into a movie, and good luck with that. You know, but and I've never, I can't even, the idea of trying to read Gravity's Rainbow today is quite frightening because it's a very dense book. But going back to Catch-22, it's, I guess one of these books, the sacred books like Catcher in the Rye, even though it's never been made into a movie, it kind of has been made into a movie with other movies in the sense, you know, that owe its very existence to Catcher in the Rye. So here you have something that actually goes ahead and makes Catch-22, and it works. I don't see what people have a problem with. You know what I would, you know, can I be a broken record? I wish Mike Nichols would have made the sequel, Closing Time.
Mm.
Even though it's not a great, you know, book, I would have loved to have seen everyone come back who could and be in it, Alan Arkin especially.
Well,
he's
there's
great as Josarian.
There's also the stage work, and you know, when and he suffered. I mean, he was close to two actors that died. I mean, essentially, they both killed themselves. One accidentally, but in Philip Seymour Hoffman and Robin Williams.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the last piece of theater he directed was Death of a Salesman with Hoffman.
Mm-hmm.
And they just said that was like a earth-shattering production of that, really spared down. I think they went back to the original production design from whenever that was written decades ago. And he directed Spamalot and... He really was, I think he won a Tony for Salesman, actually.
That was his last Tony Award. I mean, like, he won, you know, 8 Tonys. So, I mean, for, like, The Real Thing and with Jeremy Irons. And, I mean, he was, you know, he was, well, I mean, he was big in every medium. I mean, in the 60s, you know, of course, with Elaine May, you know, on stage. You know, Arthur Penn directed their sort of their Broadway review. And then they were huge on television as a team as well. I mean, you can go on YouTube. And this, when I found out that he passed away, instead of going to his movies, actually, I actually went on YouTube and somebody has set up a channel that has all of the TV appearances of Mike Nichols and Elaine May. So I wanted to go and take a look at some of that stuff, and that stuff is just brilliant, and you really get a sense of what he's – well, you get the sense of what he's like as a performer. And also you also get a sense of the setting up of the breaking down of sexual taboos and so forth that came to fruition in the first two movies and in Carnal Knowledge as well. So,
right.
So you really – that was the first thing that I did, because I had really never jumped into – that stuff, and it made me want to listen to some of the records. I also watched the American Masters thing on Elaine May and Mike Nichols, and in that they play some of the records, which he also won a Grammy for those. So he's one of the few people who's won an Emmy, a Grammy,
yeah.
A Tony, and
he's won all four.
Yeah.
What do they call it? Like an EGOT or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
An EGOT. Yeah. So. But he was huge in every single medium, in television, records, stage, movies. You know, it's just unbelievable. You know what a career.
And I think it really built. Hang on, Adam's here. Hang on, Adam. Hey, bud.
Hey guys, how are you?
Hey.
Hey, Adam.
We're talking Mike Nichols here.
I assumed as much. Yeah.
Yes.
Bro, that's been terrible. We've been discussing that for the last couple of days, all my close friends and I. It's awful, but, you know, a full life, though.
Well, yeah, a really full life. And everybody loved him. I mean, and all the recollections of him that I read, I mean, Pacino said it was the best director he'd ever worked with. And, you know, lots of people have come out. Everybody loved him. He never raised his temper. He was so even on the set and loving and nurturing. And he had a beautiful life and as rich and varied and fulfilling a career as you could imagine. And he died at the age of 83. I mean, there's a roundtable, the director roundtable on Hollywood Reporter, and the news had just broke that Mike Nichols had died before they started taping the roundtable. And so they brought it up, and Bennett Miller is one of the people in the roundtable, and he said that he was really close to Mike Nichols. He started crying, actually, as he started speaking, and Bennett Miller isn't kind of like outwardly emotional kind of person.
Right.
But he said, you know, just yesterday I texted him like three different times, and, you know, and then he just died suddenly of a heart attack hours later. So it was a big shock for a lot of people. But that life, I mean, what a full life. You have to be happy with that legacy.
Mm-hmm. And a career that just stayed completely relevant all the way to the very end. I mean, it was only last year or maybe a year before that he was doing, you know, Death of a Salesman on Broadway. So, yeah, it's ridiculous. And, yeah, it's still a tremendous loss, though, because I still, you know, whenever somebody passes away like this, you know, I think, you know, no more work by them, you know.
Yeah, no, it's a sad thing, and especially someone who, you know, I'm sure could have done, at least one or two more films, at least.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another thing too. It's interesting, like, you know, a lot of times when older people are in the business, you know, they kind of get left behind, kind of, and nobody was prepared to leave him behind. They always were willing to embrace him, mainly because actors, in particular, just loved him so that they would. Go to the ends of the earth to do things with him. So,
yeah. Well, what's your favorite? What's your favorite, Adam Nichols?
God, I don't know. I mean, there's so many. I mean, The Graduate, Carnal Knowledge. You know, even some of the ones in the '90s, like Wolf. I mean, that's not my favorite.
Wolf. It's not your favorite, but I think the idea and what it talks about, though. Like, I remember talking about that with a lot of friends. You know, while the execution may not be, you know, perfect, it's that at least it what it wants to tackle is very interesting.
The art direction is amazing in Wolf. The set decoration is just in that office with the caged elevators, and I just love that.
Well, you know, that's the Bradbury building in L.A.,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been used in tons of movies. So, but it's a great location.
I'm glad they used it in that one. Because it says something about that character and about, you know, the wolf alter ego and you know, mm-hmm. thematically right to do it in that building.
Yeah,
failures were interesting failures, I think. All of them. I mean, there wasn't anything he didn't make films that you could say, you know, well, gosh, that's, you know, there's nothing in there that makes it worth seeing. There was always something, to me anyway, that made
you
were
curious. You were always curious what he would do. But I want to say this, though. We're talking, because there's this whole thing that, you know, being a film director, for the most part, is one of these jobs you can do up till the day you die. If you can get behind the camera, if you have, you know, a certain level, I guess, of credibility and respect, you can basically do this well into your 80s or 90s as long as you're healthy. And he was one of these guys that would have gone till the very end. I mean, if he could have, he would have, you know, if he didn't. You know, it's very sudden. This is a cardiac arrest in the middle of the night.
Well, of course, he was working on another film.
If you have the talent, because what I'm trying to say here is if you have the talent and you have the, not even the energy, but if you have
stamina.
The talent and the stamina, you can do this till the day you die. This is where I violently disagree with Tarantino. Oh, I don't want to be like the Hitchcock of Family Plot. Dude, you should be so lucky that you get that old and be able to make Family Plot, first of all.
I totally agree, yeah.
We've talked about this on the show, you know.
Yeah.
The vast majority of directors don't have the stamina to work, at least to do the same level of work that made them great. I'm talking about the great directors now. the same level of stamina to.
But it's not even stamina. It's just it's one of these jobs that I do think if you, first of all, and I guess in today's day and age, if you can get the first of all the money, the backing, and the distribution, but you can't do it. But I just think he's one of these. Nichols was one of these guys who could, you know, like you said, he's working on another film. But he could have gone on for, I think there are at least two more films there. There are several directors like that. And then there are some of the other directors who we've interviewed who just piss and moan that they won't do certain films. And I think if you're allowed to get behind the camera, I don't care whether it is, just try to make it the best you can. But Mike Nichols was
Well, ideally, you would think that the older you get, the more interesting things you have to say. I mean, because our artists kind of feed on their life experience, and the more life experience you have under your belt, the more you have to share. But he was extremely versatile. I mean, he could do The Birdcage, and then he could do Closer. I mean, come on.
Yeah, that's a great movie. I was going to say, that's a great one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, amongst his, I don't know if this is just a movie that I don't hear people talking about, even though he got an Oscar nomination for it for Best Director, but Silkwood, to me, is like, right after those first three that I mentioned, Virginia Woolf will always be my favorite of his movies. Graduate, absolutely number two. Carnal Knowledge, absolutely number three. But then I go to number four, and then it has to be Silkwood, and I just think,
right.
And then for me, number five would be Primary Colors. That's how great I think Primary Colors is. But Silkwood to me is just devastating, and it's also a movie that feels. It's a movie that takes place in a completely different place than any of his other movies do. It's really the only movie that he ever did that takes place in the South. So I think that's an interesting. Well, I guess Biloxi Blues, too. It wasn't a movie. It takes place in the South, but it's not a movie about the South. Let's put it that way. So Silkwood, to me, felt like a movie. That was about working class people, and for me it just feels completely different from any of his other movies, for that reason, and it doesn't just feel different because of those subject matters too, or the setting, but also there's a certain sort of quietude to it that feels different, and. There's also like a certain sort of like a dire sort of seriousness that he very rarely touched on. I think he did in the other movies that I mentioned that are some of my favorites. But there's something about that film, and about that woman's story and everything that just really really resonates with me. And I think it should be. It should be in the conversation as one of his greatest movies, I guess is what I'm saying.
I think so too. I love Postcards from the Edge too. But I think about Silkwood often. I mean, actually, that was the first movie we mentioned tonight in relation to Mike Nichols. It's a very powerful movie. I'll always remember Pauline Kael's negative review of it because I just thought she was so off base in that review. Altman gave Cher her first break, and then she followed that up with Silkwood. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just a year later, yeah.
Silkwood was a big deal. I mean, Silkwood is a very important movie. I would say Silkwood, after the China Syndrome, like really a bad, you talk about double features you don't want to do, but that's quite a double feature.
That would make a great double bill, I think. That would make a great double bill. Mm-hmm.
Silkwood and what else?
The China Syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it does play, it's like the corporate whistle. I mean, there's a whole subgenre of corporate whistleblowers. Whistleblowers. From that
Silkwood.
To the insider to, yeah.
I mean, Aaron Brockovich would be the obvious heir to Silkwood. You couldn't have Aaron Brockovich without Silkwood, I don't think.
You know what's interesting about Mike Nichols, though? I'm looking at his career, 22 movies, including one short, one documentary, and two TV movies. And I'm sitting here looking at his career, and as great as he was and everything, and as great as Catch-22 and Carnal Knowledge is, 1970, 1971, he really wasn't there in the 70s contributing a whole lot to the 70s,
Outside of Cardinal Knowledge and The Graduate, it was because that's when he really started suffering major setbacks, and
mm-hmm.
he one after another just wouldn't fly for him, like The Day of the Dolphin and The Fortune and Catch 22 didn't succeed, and he had Cardinal
and Guild Alive.
But I
want to
say,
it really set him back. So he had to sit on kind of the sidelines through that whole period.
Yeah,
it really feels like he's kind of gone from 73 until 83, like he's like just doing stage work and stuff, like really. But
yeah,
it's the failures that set him back.
It's like Altman in the early 80s. I think the same thing
uh-huh.
happened to Mike Nicholson.
The Day of the Dolphin, and especially The Fortune, let's be honest, the four of us would be lined up. If Warren Beatty and Jack Nicholson did another film,
I think that was the problem with The Fortune, because Warren Beatty and Jack Nicholson were lined up and they were ready to make the movie. They just didn't have a movie.
We would be lined up to see another movie with those two. We would love to see a movie with those two right
well,
now.
Well, actually, to tell you the truth, to this day, I've still never seen The Fortune because it's never – I mean, Adam, you could answer this. Has this ever gotten a major release on –
Yes,
on,
it's on Blu-ray. It's on Blu-ray. It's Twilight
is?
Time. Yeah, the company that
Twilight
never releases
time.
Anything that anyone wants to see, according to Adam.
Yeah. But The Day of the Dolphin, even though it's not a popular movie, it's a good movie. It's a good movie.
I can remember you talking about Day of the Dolphin with William Fraker,
DP
of it.
That's right.
So, yeah.
That's another film that I think I've only seen parts of, you know, Day of the Dolphin.
Can I say something? Can I just say something about Day of the Dolphin? You haven't lived till your older brother quotes from Day of the Dolphin when you're like in the 70s, okay?
I remember people quoting it because of what was the dolphin's name?
Fa Loves B is the famous.
Right, yeah. So people did resonate with people back in the 70s. Like,
yes,
especially
my
kids
brother was
for some
one
reason.
Of them.
Yeah, yeah, it did. It's interesting,
okay.
too, that in this after Silkwood, you know, if you look at his career after Silkwood, it's primarily all comedy movies, like until, I mean, Heartburn, Biloxi Blues, Working Girls, Postcards from the Edge, maybe not regarding Henry, and Wolf a little, but Birdcage, Primary Colors even. It's like a large amount of comedy work. So he has to be considered one of the great comedy directors of all time as well.
I would think, without a doubt.
You know, and I mean, that makes sense from where he came from.
Well,
he
was known for
with
yeah.
Elaine May. So,
yeah.
But imagine
like breaking in, like your first movie being Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. So your first movie,
that?
you're there directing Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton.
That's insane.
You're like
that's...
in the middle. You're in the middle of the maelstrom, and furthermore, to have it done and complete, and then just when you look at it, it's just such a total knock out of the park. It's just so ridiculous how great that
Can
movie is.
Can I ask
is.
A question though? Chronology wise, is that the first Burton Taylor marriage, or is this the second Burton Taylor marriage?
Because they got divorced
and then remarried.
It's the first one because they got divorced and remarried like back in the 70s. So this is the Cleopatra marriage.
Oh my gosh! I'm sorry, guys. That would have been the greatest to be a fly on the wall during the making of that movie.
They were both working at the – I mean, I think after Cleopatra, they were really, really – and some of the other things that they would do, because they did some other movies that weren't so great together. But I think they were really hungry to do something that would really resonate with people.
It really showed Elizabeth Taylor completely ravaged. I mean, that was – which is was different from the glamour – Liz Taylor that we were accustomed to prior to that.
Here's a double feature for you. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and the VIPs? Then get back to me.
That's another one I've never seen. I've never seen the VIPs.
Oh,
I've never seen, like,
movie.
The Sandpiper. Is that something that they did together?
Don't know off the top of my head, but...
Here's a double feature for you. The VIPs and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. How about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and V.I. Warshawski? That's...
right, dude, I'm there, man.
Okay, can we get to the Blu-rays?
Yeah.
Okay, well...
Hey, by the way, Adam...
Has
Twilight Time released V.I. Warshawski yet?
I think somebody has.
Except for
January. I don't think it's Twilight Time, but I do believe it is available. And by the way, The Fortune is available. Seriously, you can get it as a you can stream it on Amazon, so it is available.
Oh, really?
To stream. Yeah, you can do that.
You can buy the Blu-ray.
Yeah.
it's on Blu-ray.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so. But they're not. It may be out of print now because they have the limited editions, you know, on the Twilight Time. So they're just advertising it as being available currently as a streamer. So anyway, for anybody who wants to see The Fortune, the Mike Nichols film, that might be an option. So there you go.
That's good. Good to know.
This is a very good
lot of stuff on Amazon.
Yeah. So. Anyway, all right. Well, are you guys ready?
Yeah, I think
I'm
we're
ready.
What do we do? We're covering December, right?
No, November actually, because we haven't done November, so we're running a couple. We didn't get our October Blu-ray report until a couple weeks into the month, so we're a couple of weeks behind. But that's okay. There's a few things that should spurn some discussion for you guys.
Okay.
So,
I'm hoping.
So anyway, we'll start with November 4th, and here's one that should get you the tongues wagging, so to speak. The Ninth Configuration, William Peter Blatty's 1980 film. yeah.
Which is seriously as insane as the characters that are in it. I mean, like, a really, really wild and and almost indescribable movie. I'm like, I'm kind of without words with it.
I agree with you for once, Dean. That's probably the most. This is the one thing we should come in agreement for.
I mean, the dialogue in that film, and I guess it's because William Peter Blatty, since he was directing it, he was just able just to go nuts with it. And it was originally released as Twinkle Twinkle Killer Kane, right? Or was
that
the name of the book?
Right.
Or because I remember it won best. This was weird, but at the Golden Globes that year that it came out, I think in 1980 or whatever, it won best screenplay, and it was the one movie that was nominated that year. I remember looking at the nominations and going, "What is Twinkle Twinkle Killer Kane?" So I had no chance of winning, and then it won. And I was like, what the hell? What is this? And for years, I didn't, you know, I couldn't find the movie because it just has a strange history, that film. So are there any good extras on it, on this?
It's being released by a company called Hen's Tooth.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually issued on regular DVD several years back, The Groove Tube. The 1974, you know, sketch movie. So
I love it.
Yeah, I do too. But it had nothing extra on it, so I'm assuming this is probably going to be bare bones. And I don't, you know, there's so many cuts of this film. That's the other thing. I don't know what exactly constitutes the official cut of this film, the William Peter Blatty version. I mean, he hasn't had much luck with the films he's directed, which I think there are only two, of course, but. There's been a lot of studio interference with this one and Exorcist 3, of course, which he, you know, directed as well, which was, you know, his official sequel to The Exorcist and based on
the novel. One with George C. Scott?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the good one. That was actually pretty good.
It was good, but I think it would have been better because there was a lot of post-production tinkering with the studio. It was Morgan Creek, I believe, and if you look at the trailer, if you get a chance to look at that trailer, there's all kinds of stuff in that trailer that didn't make it to the final cut that really looks like it would have been good. And I don't know. I hear there's a fan edit out there somewhere. How to get your hands on it, I have no idea. But I hear it's they've somehow found some of that footage. It's not an official release, but if they say it's really good, so I would love to see his original version. And it wasn't called Exorcist 3; it was called Legion. That was his original
right
name.
Yeah,
Yeah, so
yeah.
So he hasn't had much luck with, you know, when he's gone out to direct a film, and now he's way up in his 80s now, too, so that's another guy that's
well,
up
still,
there.
Still, though, I mean, like, Knight Configuration is something that is incredibly unique, and I wouldn't say it's for everybody, but as a, it is something you won't forget, so, and it's got many moments in it that just leave your mouth dropping. So, but and a good cast, really good cast.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. It's a once in it's an interesting experience. Let's just say that.
Mm-hmm.
We also have Viva Maria, which was the Louis Malle film from 1965. I've never seen that one. I really can't pass judgment on it. I don't know if any of you guys have ever seen it.
What is it now? Which one is it?
Viva Maria, Louis Malle, from 65.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. If
there's a lot of the 60s Louis Malles that I've never seen. So, but that's good.
Yeah, that's coming out. Also have Pete Kelly's Blues. Anybody remember this? Jack Webb film.
Yeah.
Like I saw this when I was a kid, but I don't remember enough about it to pass a.
Is it a jazz movie?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Yeah, I think he plays a trumpeter or something of that nature.
Okay.
I can't remember. I saw it when I was a kid. But anyway, The Doctor and the Devils, which is a Freddie Francis
film.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
Underrated. Underrated.
Yeah.
That's a version of the whole Burke and Hare story about the guys that were stealing bodies out of the in the late 1800s,
right.
Stealing bodies out of the cemeteries and selling them to doctors who needed them for research, and it, of course it's been done by Robert Wise as the body snatcher with Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi. And it was done as Burke and Hare a few years ago with Simon Pegg, I think, and I can't remember who else was in it, but I think this is one of the best versions of it. And of course, it comes from a screenplay by that was long unproduced by the poet Dylan Thomas, and Freddie Francis directing. It was one of the first films, actually, that I saw when I went to New York City. My first trip to New York City, I wanted to see something that I thought would not make it down to Atlanta. So I drugged my cousin, who was with me at the time, to go see Doctor and the Devils. And he was kind of bored by it, as were many people, but many critics and so forth. But I thought it was great. I mean, like, maybe not great, but just, like, as a telling of that story, I thought it was quite unique with Timothy Dalton in the lead, by the way.
Yeah, I've never seen it. It's a blind spot for me, and now you guys have me have my curiosity aroused, so I think I will definitely seek it out.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's worth it.
Well, Freddie Francis, you know, he was well established as a cinematographer, and he did direct a few films. And the ones he did were generally interesting films.
A lot of those Amicus movies and stuff, like Tales
right.
from the Crypt and so forth. Those horror films, you know, that are done in five different stories. And also, by the way, produced by since Freddie Francis had photographed the Elephant Man, I think that's how he got connected with Mel Brooks, because Mel Brooks was one of the producers on David Lynch's movie. So Mel Brooks is also the producer of this film as well. So
now that I didn't know, so that's something I wasn't aware of. But yeah, I'll see that one. Definitely sounds like it's worth seeking out for sure.
Yeah.
Well, we'll move on to November the 11th, because that pretty much covers the 4th. And this isn't really a film, but it's worth mentioning that the Batman complete television series has finally made its way to Blu-ray and DVD after being in rights limbo for many, many,
mm-hmm.
many years. So don't know if you guys want to say anything about that. But
well, for a lot of us, this was our introduction to Batman, I think.
wouldn't you say, Dean? I mean, growing up watching this, I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
I mean, this was our
that was, this was what we thought Batman was, and that this
yeah,
is exactly
this
why
Batman
you
was.
Know
mm-hmm. exactly.
It's
and
exactly
so,
why when Burton's movie came out, it was such a seismic. You know, it was like an earthquake when that movie
yeah.
came out because it was so radically different. It did not have that. It did not have the campy. I mean, like campy is not even the word for the Batman movie. It's like ultra camp.
Well, I'll give you a better example more than Burton. It was when Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns graphic novel or the comic book came out, and some friends of mine showed it to me in high school, and I was just like, wow, I didn't know this was Batman. You know, it's like, wow, this is Batman? Because my,
mm-hmm.
my knowledge of Batman really did, it was informed by Adam West. I mean, so,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Tim Burton film in the Frank Miller comics are just like such, you know, like, wow, I had no idea.
But we will forget, back to the television show, we forget that the TV show was the absolute number one show on television all throughout the 60s,
mm-hmm.
all throughout its run.
Yeah.
People
were killed to get on that.
People, all of Hollywood wanted a role in it. Like, I mean, like, even if they couldn't get a role as a villain, they wanted to be like one of the people sticking their head out of the window as Robin
yeah.
and Batman are climbing up the buildings
mm-hmm.
and so forth. People were, you know, it was definite must-see television back then. And people were really ravenous over it. And then, of course,
mm-hmm.
when it was all over it went into syndication, it was still just as huge as it ever was.
Right.
And of course, there was even a Batman movie back then, too.
There was, that's right.
There wasn't. It was like an original movie. It wasn't just two episodes stuck together. I don't think it was.
I think you're absolutely right. It was. I mean,
so that's actually maybe the first Batman movie. Other than, I guess Batman was done as a was it done as a serial back in the
it 40s? It was. Yeah, back in the 40s, I think.
Yeah.
I wonder who was the first person to play Batman. Does anybody know this?
I don't know. It was not Elmo Lincoln, though. So,
yeah, I don't
but,
know the
file. Yeah, who was it? Do you know?
I don't know off the top of my head. I might be able
I
to
don't
find
know
out
either,
real
right.
fast, but.
Okay, but yeah, I mean, you know, I wonder how much stomach fans of Batman have now for original television show.
They want this
yeah.
very badly because
they do. Okay.
Yes, because people just want something lighthearted.
Mm-hmm.
There was actually, there was a big demand for this because I think after the heaviness of the Nolan films and everything, while those are good, well done movies and everything, people just wanted to be laugh again.
I'm wondering if the Nolan fans feel this way though. Do they?
Everyone wants to have a look. How shall I say it? You know, everyone wants a good laugh at the end of the day.
Just not in the movies.
I mean, you know, you can't, how can I say it? The way Nolan, those three films are set up, you really, unfortunately, you can have little asides. Like, I think in Batman Begins, there's actually some humor, but after that, forget it.
It's pretty fleeting.
Once Heath Ledger dies, you can't have humor, obviously.
There was a couple of lighthearted moments in Dark Knight Rises.
Oh, there are a lot of lighthearted moments in the Dark Knight Rises even, but you know everyone liked the Adam West ones because I think everyone, including I'm sure even Nolan himself, grew up on those too.
Mm-hmm.
You can't help. I mean, obviously. When they were going to cast, originally Bill Murray was going to play Batman, before Michael Keaton, so it was going to go a whole different way. It would have gone more towards the Adam West school than it would have gone, in other ways, because he was going to play Batman at one time. So,
do you think? Let me just get you guys' opinion on this. Do you think that the reason that this show had such a hard time getting to DVD or Blu-ray or whatever, as we're discussing now, do you think the reason for that is because of the sheer number of stars and stuff that were in it that they just had to? iron out all of those rights issues and stuff?
I think so.
I think what it was what I'm understanding is that Fox was responsible for the television series, and in the years since then, of course, Warner Brothers has taken over the DC Comics for the most part.
Right.
You know, they've taken control, and see, that's where the problem is. It's been a tug of war between Fox and Warner Brothers, according to what I know. Now, I may be wrong, and somebody can correct me. But and I think
that makes sense, though.
Yeah, I think they've been doing this tap dance, Fox and Warner Brothers, all you know, for a decade and a half, you know, trying to iron it out between the two of them and come to something that was agreeable to both sides, and they just couldn't do it. I mean, you know, and I think that's finally what eventually happened, that they finally somehow or another ironed it out. But that's what it was. So, according to what I know.
I tell you what, when you look at the it is ridiculous the number of people who were on this show, even just for a couple of episodes, even if they were just, I would almost, I don't think that there's a show that has more, a higher level of guest stars than this show. I mean, like, mm-hmm. you know, just going with the ones that everybody knows, like Cesar Romero and Burgess Meredith and Julie Newmar and Frank Gorshin. But also, you know, Vincent Price, Estelle Winwood, Cliff Robertson, you know, Rudy Valley, you know, and then, you know, all the people who were also, you know, Ethel Merman, you know.
Right.
But all the people who were doing supporting things like Bruce Lee and Everett Horton. And it's ridiculous the number of names. Woody Strode and...
It's crazy.
It's for me, the real reason to watch the Batman show would be to see the guest stars on it, because there's just so many. There's so many people who are also getting their first, who would become bigger in the 70s, who are getting their first shot on this too. So it doesn't just go backwards; it goes forwards as well. So Seymour Cassell and all sorts of people in it. It's nuts. So I have to say, I'd be interested in watching it.
Yeah, and Lewis Wilson was the 1943 Batman, by the way. So for whatever it's worth.
Lewis Wilson, somebody who never gets talked about.
His last credit was 1954. Let's put it that way.
Wow.
Okay.
So anyway, we'll take a look at Twilight Time's releases for November 11th. We were making a joke about Twilight Time a while ago. Here are their limited edition releases. There are only 3,000 units of each one of these films, but they've got Birdman of Alcatraz.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, When the Wind Blows.
That's a high end one for them, Burt Lancaster.
Oh, it is.
That is.
John Frankenheimer.
Well, When the Wind Blows is another one. Bunny Lake is missing.
When the Wind Blows. Okay, so hold on. Let me just stop
Second. Yeah.
When the Wind Blows, just to let people know, that's the animated movie, right? The Japanese animated movie?
I think so, yes.
British. And that is a really devastating movie, just for people, if you've never seen this. This is an animated film. It's animated by Jimmy Murakami, I think, but it's British, really. So I forget the two actors who were doing the voices in it. I think somebody like Joan Plowright, or I can't remember. But it's basically two older people who are living in rural England, and they're hearing through the news about, you know, rumblings of a possible nuclear war.
That's right.
And they're making their own little – they're taking the steps that everybody told them to take, you know, get in the cellar, get some food and everything like that. But then when the nuclear war finally hits, they see the real effects of the aftermath of the bomb. So – and it is absolutely devastating, and one of the great movies. I mean, I would put it up there in the pantheon of great nuclear war movies with Strange Love, with Failsafe, Threads, Day After. It definitely
belongs.
It's
based on the Raymond Briggs book.
We have the book somewhere, but it's actually based on the guy who wrote the Father Christmas books. I have the book. So we have the book somewhere, but this is a huge deal when it came out, the book and the movie. I mean, these were big.
Well, I don't remember hearing about them in America, really. It was 1986, and it's Peggy Ashcroft and John Mills, I think. It's Peggy Ashcroft and John Mills. It's the two leads. It was something. It's mid '80s, and I didn't even remember seeing it on. I only saw it like a couple, maybe two or three years ago.
I don't even know if my brother might have thrown out the book when he cleaned out the basement like 30 years ago. But I remember the book because my mom bought it because, like I said, Father Christmas and the Snowman, these were big.
That was a huge thing.
The guy who did these would do this, then all of a sudden just thought this was very serious, very scary book, terrifying. If you want to know when you're a kid and everything, that's some still scary stuff. I mean, so
it is. It will surprise you. I guarantee you. 98% of the people listening to this show haven't even seen it. But it is surprising how powerful it is. So.
Well, we joke about Twilight Time, but they really do have a good roster of releases. November 11th. Well, it's already come and gone, but they're out. But Bunny Lake is Missing, Otto Preminger's 1965 film, and the Twilight Samurai from 2002, and Judgment at Nuremberg.
That's a great movie.
Twilight Samurai. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a wonderful movie.
And the last one was Judgment at Nuremberg, which, what else can you say about that? So
that's just one of the greats that I return to again and again, even though a lot of people kind of poo-poo everything that Stanley Kramer did, I think that movie is just brilliant all the way through. It's so riveting. Bunny Lake is Missing, too, is also a very, very interesting movie from the mid-60s, Otto Preminger, and probably a movie that couldn't be made today. I don't think that movie could be made today because it deals with the whole issue of child molestation and so forth, and
yeah.
People are just too, they're just too hysterical about that to even have a movie made about it, even if it's a serious film. Great performances from Carol Lindley and Keir Dulley and also isn't Ralph Richardson in it as well?
And also
for the music fans out there, the Zombies, the British band The Zombies, made an appearance in it too, and a great Saul Bass credit sequence as well.
Yeah.
So hey, Adam, Twilight Time will release The Fortune on Blu-ray on December 9th.
Okay. I was wondering why it wasn't advertised on Amazon. Okay. That makes sense. Okay. Well, it's coming. It's on the way. So interesting timing considering right here at the death of Mike Newton.
Yeah.
So.
I think it's a conspiracy. I think they actually killed him so they could sell more copies. That's what I think.
That's what it was. Yeah.
If they come out and they say instead of 3,000 copies, we're making 6,000, then we'll know that it's true.
That's right. Yeah.
They're going to make their own fortune.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Well, we got a couple of 80s horror films here. We got Demons and Demons 2 and Dolls. So I don't know if there's anything anybody wants to say about those, but they're all coming out on Blu-ray, just in case.
Okay.
And anyway, here's something else that this is a kid. Now, you talk about films that have never been issued on DVD or Blu-ray, and this was barely issued on VHS tape, but you remember Mandingo, of course, is infamous. We all know about that.
But there was a sequel.
Well, that's what I'm getting at. Dino De Laurentiis had this plan that he was going to – there's a bunch of those novels, that Mandingo is based on, and they had a plan that they were going to issue – they were going to film them all, basically, and it was going to be like this, I guess the James Bond of slave sagas or something. I don't know what they were playing. But anyway, they only filmed one more, which was Drum. And
right.
Drum is coming out on Blu-ray, believe it or not, which is interesting. But, you know, Mandingo was probably one of the most offensive mainstream films. It's, I mean, when you see the film today, it's almost inconceivable that Paramount would have put that film in theaters, even in the mid-70s when mindsets were totally different. I mean, I watched it not too long ago, and it's unbelievable that that could get in theaters.
It makes me want to watch it immediately. It makes me want to watch it immediately. Because, you know what, I don't think I've seen it all the way through, Mandy.
Oh, it's so inappropriate.
There's a bunch of films from back then that you would that could not be made today. Bucktown could not be made today.
I'm going through, you know, I'm doing these collages of 70s, you know, movie ads and stuff. And so I'm going through my collection all the time. And, of course, I'm in Atlanta, and they're from an Atlanta paper in the 70s. And so every black movie played here. I mean, every black – I mean, what a rich – say what you will about these movies, but what a rich period for black film, like much richer than the 80s, 90s, or 2000s have been, even though we're further down the road in terms of, I guess, race relations or whatever, or maybe we're not.
I don't think we're actually not would be the appropriate thing to say.
We're probably not. It's an illusion. But with the 70s, at least in terms of film, I mean, black film back then was ridiculous. And also, you are correct in saying that there was a lot of stuff that couldn't be done today. I mean, like, I have to say what the names of these movies are because these are the names of these movies, so I'm going to say them. But, you know, I just watched Fred Williamson in Boss Nigger, which
That's
is
what
a,
I was
going
to say. That one and the
which is
the legend of the N-word Charlie.
Yeah, so I mean, there was the Legend of Nigger Charlie and also the Soul of Nigger Charlie.
Right.
Yeah.
And
how could you get those made today? How could you even think about getting those made?
Black film back then was just, I mean, not just those kind of movies, you know, exploitation movies, but things like Cornbread Earl and Me or Cooley High or Claudine, Sounder. Or Conrack even. It was just a ridiculously rich time for black film.
Well, one of the most interesting things about Drum and Mandingo, you know, they're written by Norman Wexler, who went on to write Saturday Night Fever and also wrote Serpico. So
right.
whatever it's worth, the same scribe behind those films penned Mandingo. But again, Mandingo is just, it's unbelievable. It defies description. It's like a septic tank explosion. You have to see it to believe it. So it really is.
So Drum, do you think Drum, who did Drum, by the way?
Well, same writer, of course, Norman Wexler. It's a different director. But I can't recall who the director was. And I have Drum ripped off an old VHS tape, and I've never seen Drum, to be honest. I never have. I've seen Mandingo on several occasions, but I never did get around to watching Drum. I need to.
Mandingo was done by Richard Fleischer, who had an incredibly rich career. Went all over the place. And was also the son of Max Fleischer, either Max or Dave Fleischer, the animators, the famous animators. But it was Steve Carver that did Drum, so it's
a little bit
of a drop off. But it does have in case you're it does have Pam Grier in it, Yaphet Kotto, and Warren Oates is in the lead. So if you're a Warren Oates fan,
yeah, no, check this out.
And speaking of Warren Oates and things of that nature, while we're on that note, I will say Criterion is issuing a double feature of The Shooting and Ride in the Whirlwind, the Monty Hellman films, as a double deal. So two for the price.
Yeah, this is a big deal. He's very excited.
Monty is
very interesting. Monty Hellman was on Facebook when he was talking about this a couple of weeks ago.
Yep.
And he doesn't care too much for commentaries or anything, and I got to say, sometimes I agree with him on that, but he was very impressed with what they did with these films. He was very impressed by the presentation, everything about these, so I would like to get this at some point.
Yeah, they're great films. They really are.
we're mentioning Monty Hellman here, and I'm friends with him on Facebook too. But I just for the people who aren't friends with him on Facebook, you should friend him because he's interesting. But
oh, very interesting.
But you know what he's doing? He is actually offering people, anybody, an opportunity to stay with him for a week at his place in California, wherever it is. He's offering like a high-end bed and breakfast.
He has to do it. I think he has to do it because this is how he's making a living. This and the master class that he was doing for a couple of years
right. Is
how he's making a living right now. Is what
I think that's interesting, though. Isn't that fascinating? Like, I've never heard of anybody doing this ever.
I
don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's a good thing.
No, it's not a bad thing at all.
I think it's kind of a wonderful, like, reach out to the fans and everything. He gets to.
Can I say something, Dean? Have you read some of those posts over the years? Some of the people who stayed with him had no idea he was a filmmaker.
Oh, really?
Oh, no. They have stayed with him and they had no idea. And he shows them his films and everything. Some of them had no idea. So he's doing this. I think, it's a sad state of affairs. You know, we know who Monty Hellman is. We like some of his movies. And we know, but, you got to hand it to him. It's a very creative way to pay the bills and everything. So,
but surely he made he got a producer credit on Pulp Fiction, so that should have.
Well, Reservoir Dogs, I think.
Oh, Reservoir Dogs. Sorry. Okay,
but,
Reservoir
Dogs. You know, look, the guy who produced Crash was declared bankruptcy before that came out. So, producing credit really doesn't buy you much, but. I always looked at it as a very creative way for him to, make a living because there's a lot of creative accounting and everything. And, like I said, we know who Monty Hellman is. We love him and everything. The vast majority of the public out there doesn't know who he is.
Well, let me just say this, that I saw the rate that he was offering and everything, and I thought it was eminently reasonable. And if I was ever going out to L.A., that's who I would go.
I would stay. I would move in. I would move in with him. But I almost took his master class a couple of years ago. I was trying, I almost flew out there to take that because who wouldn't want to take that class? That's like fascinating. And then a lot of people come back who took it every time he offered it.
Well, he still does movies, though, doesn't he? He had a movie out not too long ago.
He's done two movies. The one that he did a couple of, I don't know the name of the movie, but then there's one after that. I don't know if it's been released yet, but he's a very interesting filmmaker. I'm glad to see he's still, making movies, but they're not movies that unfortunately get like a theatrical release, or at least in this country, they might not. I think there might have been.
Well, they played here. The last one played here. It was Road to Nowhere, was what it was called.
Yeah, but it didn't. It played in Atlanta.
Yeah, it did. It played. Yep.
Okay, I saw it on a DVD, but if it did play, that's great. Got a great cast and everything, but he's just. I think it's great that he's still making movies. I'm very happy for him, but unfortunately they don't get the distribution. You would think that Tarantino would help him out, and give. I would have thought that would have happened, but unfortunately it didn't.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, there's a couple of talking about films of the 70s and such. We have a couple here that might spurn a little discussion. Also coming out November 11th, White Lightning and Gator, the Burt Reynolds.
I love those movies.
those can play every time. Those are great Burt Reynolds films.
They really are. It's a great character. I'm glad that Gator McCluskey wasn't a character that he ran into the ground either. He just left it at two movies and that's it. But that first one, with Ned Beatty, and then the second one with Jerry Reed, they're just terrific, and they've got really good music. It's a good balance of humor and action. It's a perfect example of like the kind of thing that Burt Reynolds did extremely well back in the 70s, and they're great drive-in movies too. Like at the same time as being mainstream movies, they were also great drive-in films, like the kind of like a 70s update of like, you know, Thunder Road or whatever. Great movies.
Well, speaking of Burt Reynolds, Sam Whiskey's also being issued from 1969. That's a blind spot for me. I don't know that one, but
I know of it, but I haven't seen it. So
I don't know that one at all.
Yeah, that's getting issued. So is More Dead Than Alive with Vincent Price and Clint Walker. That's another one from the late 60s. I'm not too familiar with it, but
wow, I don't even know that title.
Yeah, it's about some guy who I think it's Clint Walker. He becomes a sharpshooter. He's working in a circus or something like that. And some of his old enemies come to settle scores or something. And Vincent Price hires him or something. I'm kind of vague on the plot, but it looks like it could be interesting.
Like a horror film though. Like,
no, it's not a horror film. It's kind of more of a revenge film from what I'm getting. But anyway, More Dead Than Alive. Yeah.
So who stars in More Dead Than Alive?
That's Clint Walker and Vincent Price.
I didn't have the music cue up loud enough. Okay, go ahead.
Well, we have Sands of Iwo Jima is coming out, and there is a 25th anniversary edition of UHF, the Weird Al film.
Mm.
Wow, right at the height of Weird Al mania. I guess we're at the height of it, or maybe it's about to go back down to normal levels.
No, it was his first number one album.
He did very well recently. So.
And now he's like on some commercial or something. He's doing some commercial.
Yeah, Radio Shack.
Commercial for Radio Shack. UHF is also underrated.
It's funny. It is funny.
It kind of keeps that whole Groove Tube Kentucky Fried Movie kind of thing, and even Amazon Women on the Moon. You know, people know that one too. But
yeah,
it kind of keeps that kind of thing alive a little bit, at least until the mid-80s. By the way, why isn't anybody doing movies like that anymore? Like,
they did last year. They did Movie 43, but it wasn't very good.
Yeah, that
right,
movie
but
balls.
That wasn't was that really a spoof? What was that? Was that a spoof?
That was definitely a throwback to those anthology.
Yeah,
it was. But it was.
It didn't work.
Slapsticky
thing.
But my thing with those other movies is that they're like watching television, you know. They're like spoofs specifically of television. But was Movie 43 like supposed to be stuff that was on TV? Like,
well, I mean,
was
some,
each
some
segment
of it
supposed
was,
to be a different TV show?
It was trying
show?
To go, trying to capture that vibe, but it's hard to really.
It's hard to do that with today's TV.
It really is.
I guess so. I guess that's the reason. But
yeah, and
I
so what we had was well, we had Hugh Jackman with
should
testicles
make those
on his chin.
Again.
So.
Oh man, I can watch that zinc oxide and you science commercial or whatever from Kentucky Fried Movie over and over again. I love that.
I love Kentucky Fried Movie all the way through. Like you know everything. For a time, I used to think that Fistful of Yen was too long. The spoof of Enter the Dragon that takes about 40 minutes of the movie. But now I look at it and I think, it's pretty awesome. It's pretty good. Mm-hmm. And it's just the right length, I think.
It is.
I mean, Amazon Women on the Moon has big laughs in it too, although it's maybe a little more hit and miss. And then the Groove Tube is just absolutely fantastic as well. I mean, I don't think you would have had Saturday Night Live without the Groove Tube, frankly.
And don't forget Tunnel Vision. Remember that one with Chevy Chase?
Tunnel Vision. Jeez.
Yeah,
I wonder
that was
if that's out.
I think anthology movies in general are just so kind of hit and miss. I mean, I think we got the VHS movies, and that was like the last kind of anthology movie we had, right?
Yep.
Yeah. I don't know if I would call these anthology movies. I would call them like sketch movies or whatever. Like anthology
movies. Well, they're not a. Yeah. I mean, okay, yeah, but they're, point is they're not a single narrative.
Yeah. But okay.
Well, I was going to say you mentioned Fistful of Yen. I'll also say that there's a Bruce Lee Premier Collection coming out along those lines that has The Big Boss, Fist of Fury, Way of the Dragon, and Game of Death. So anybody who's clamoring for those early Bruce Lee films, which I don't think are any of them are particularly all that great, but anyway, that's just
But Bruce Lee fans just want to see Bruce Lee, and that's
it. Yeah, you want to see Bruce Lee. I mean, no, End of the Dragon, though, is like one of the most, I mean, yeah, End of the Dragon, Fist of Fury are actually really good movies, especially End of the Dragon.
We just did a spotlight on Enter the Dragon because earlier today we posted a film score spotlight show where we play a lot of clips, a lot of tracks from the brand new film soundtrack releases. I just decided to put them all in one show, and they just re-released Enter the Dragon, Lalo Schifrin score.
Yeah, that's a great score.
With unreleased tracks. So, like demos and stuff in it. So that's one of the tracks that we play on the show. So.
Well, let's see. We'll move on to November 18th now. You're talking about Altman films. This is one that's never, I don't think it's ever been issued on DVD, certainly not Blu-ray. Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean is finally
one of his great movies. One of his great movies from the 70s. I mean, from the 80s.
That was his whole unemployment period where he had to adapt stage plays into. Didn't he make that for Showtime? Is that who he made that for?
Yes, he did. You're correct.
Yeah, so Cher and Sandy Dennis, and gave Sandy Dennis a great part, right?
And Kathy Bates, right? Is it Kathy Bates in that?
I think maybe I can't. It's been a while since I've seen it, but you might be right about that.
I have to look it up now. But, Karen Black as well. Kathy Bates is the other woman in their circle.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit pre-Kathy Bates fame, probably. But I'll tell you what, he really knew how to adapt a stage play to make it feel like a film. I mean, in this particular film, for instance, there's a set that they have that has mirrors in it, a lot of mirrors in it, because I guess they're at like a beauty parlor or something in it part of the time. But when they flash back into the 50s to go back, to show them in their younger, these women in their younger days, the lights go down in the set in the foreground, and the lights come up in the set in the background, and so that Altman, that constantly moving Altman camera, goes into the other set and goes through those two-way mirrors and focuses in on the past. It's just such an incredibly inventive way to meld the stage and the cinema together. And he was doing that a lot in the 80s for some of his cable and TV work.
Here's a movie I'm curious to see if you guys know or are aware of. It's one of my favorite Christmas horror films, if that's a genre, I'm not sure. But Christmas Evil from 1980.
I've never seen it.
This is one that's highly recommended by John Waters. It's the movie he's constantly plugging every chance he gets, but it's definitely something worth seeing if you haven't. It's the main character's name's Harry, and when he's a big Santa Claus fanatic, and he sees something. I can't remember what the inciting incident is, but he sees something that disturbs him as a kid, and so then as an adult, he goes around with this list. He spies on people all year long, making a list of who's naughty and nice, and then at the end of the year he goes around killing the ones who are naughty, and he works at a toy factory. I mean, it's like he's so obsessed with Christmas. It's I don't know how to describe it, but it's definitely a worthy film if you haven't seen it.
By the way, I'm looking at the cover of the DVD, and it's this hilarious.
It's great. I'm telling you,
it's a hilarious illustration on the cover with the killer Santa Claus holding a bloody knife.
But it's Jeffrey, so over the top. It's one of those that's over the top that, you know, to the point where you're laughing more than more than anything else. You know,
that sounds like fun.
Yeah, it's really good. I highly recommend that. If any of you out there haven't seen it, it's worth seeking out. And also, the Hal Ashby film Coming Home is finally getting Blu-ray treatment, which is good.
That's good.
Of course.
Yeah.
And It Happened One Night. Criterion's doing the Frank Capra film. You've got Kiki's Delivery Service and The Wind Rises. Disney's doing both of those, and Princess Mononoke. All three of those. So
is that coming out together as a box set or something?
No, they're separate issues. They're coming out nonetheless, which is good. I'm glad they're finally giving them some Blu-ray treatment. And we have Monkey Shines and The Dark Half, both two Romero films that are kind of forgettable, if you ask me. But nonetheless, Scream Factory felt that there was enough of a demand to warrant issuing them on Blu-ray. So,
every 80s horror movie is going to get a Blu-ray release forever and ever.
Well, it looks like it does.
Everything.
We have Pocket Full of Miracles from 1961. Speaking of Capra, that was the final Capra film. And you were talking about directors who didn't. Jerry was talking about directors who could have kept on working. There's a good example right there, because he quit when he was fairly young, I think.
Like he lived on into the late 80s, right?
Right.
And, I don't know exactly he'd be an interesting person to read a biography of, because I'd be curious to know why he left the business. That was
a remake of
an earlier movie. That was a remake of an earlier film called Lady for a Day.
That's right.
That he had done in the 30s.
And I think it's the film debut of Anne Margaret, I believe. I believe that was her first film, if I'm not mistaken. I think it is. So,
yes.
Anyway.
Margaret.
Right. Yay. Anne Margaret.
And that bio that you want to get of the Frank Capra, is called The Catastrophe of Success. It is terrific, by the way.
Mm.
So if you want to seek a good one out, that's the one to go for. So, La Aventura, that comes out November 25th.
Antonioni.
Yes, uh-huh. And The Conformist, both of those are issued on the November 25th.
The Conformist is one of the most beautiful movies.
Yeah, it really is. Who's doing The Conformist?
It's not Criterion.
It's Raro Video.
Raro. There's been a couple of issuings of that. There was one that whoever came out with 1900. There was this Olive Films.
Olive Films. Yeah.
I think they did a Conformist a couple of years ago around the 1900 time.
Mm-hmm.
And that looked beautiful. So I don't know how these things change hands, and how other companies do different versions of it so close together. Wonder how that works.
I'm very curious too. In relation to that too, for instance, you know, Judgment at Nuremberg and Birdman of Alcatraz, you know, I mean, and those are movies that have been released by MGM. So how does Twilight Time, first of all, A, how does Twilight Time get the rights to do them? And B, what makes it so special to make only 3,000 copies of it when there's no extras on it? So, I mean, like, what makes their pieces so special? Do you know? Is it really just a case of it being, you know, a Blu-ray as opposed to a DVD or whatever?
I think what it is that with Twilight Time, they basically seek out titles that nobody else is going to issue. They just, you know, it's stuff that the studios just feel like, hey, we're not going to make enough profit off of this. We don't care if it ever gets issued. And so they purposely seek out these titles.
Now, these are titles, though, that are out of print. I mean, the studios did release them at one point.
Some of them are not out of print, actually. Some of them are still in print on DVD, but they, you know, they're not going to get the high definition upgrade. They're just not going to get it. They're just going to, you know, the DVD is the best it's going to be. And, you know, Twilight Time, I don't know how they go about locating these titles, but they go through and they have deals with all the major studios, not just one specific one, but they have issued stuff from basically all the major studios that I can recall. And
mm-hmm.
and they've, you know, it's funny because they've released a bunch of the Woody Allen movies. I mean, they've
mm-hmm.
done, they did Broadway Danny Rose, they did Love and Death, they did Crimes and Misdemeanors. Those were titles that MGM just didn't feel, or Fox that owns MGM now, they didn't feel like they were worth releasing. And I mean,
isn't
that's
that
sad.
Amazing?
it really, truly is
amazing. And I wonder if it's written into their contract, too, like with these bigger studios, that they can only do 3,000, so that's why it's done, you know, so in that way.
Well, I think Twilight Time is kind of a, they don't have a lot of, you know, they're kind of a low-budget company. They can only press, they don't have a lot of money for huge pressings, and so they just, they make them limited edition, and that's why they are so expensive, because they are limited, and in a lot of cases, like Body Double was a Twilight Time release, and when they issued Body Double, it sold out before it was ever actually commercially released. So there were enough pre-orders to where you could not even get one by the time it came out. And those things are going on eBay for several hundred dollars. That's what happens. They go.
Well, if you think about it, 3,000 is not when you're selling to the
right.
entire country,
entire world.
It's right.
A
yeah.
Lot. You know.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And a lot of these films, the original Fright Night, they issued that one too. And when they did, and I have a friend who bought that, and he had to wind up paying, I think, close to $100 because he couldn't, you know, it was out of print. It was gone.
Here's my other question. Here's another
yeah.
question, though. I don't know if you've gotten some of these Twilight Time movies and whether you've. Okay, so. Are they really, you know, do they look ridiculously better than they've ever looked before, or is it kind of a bait and switch or whatever? Because I've seen some Blu-rays I've gotten, and they don't really look any demonstrably any better than the DVD. So I guess that's what I'm asking.
Well, I have the only one I have right now is I have the Robert Mulligan's The Other.
Mm-hmm.
Because I felt that was a film, that's one of my favorite films of all time. I think it's one of the greatest horror films of all time, and I felt like that warranted me paying whatever I had to pay to get the highest quality pressing of that. And so I did, and it does have the isolated Jerry Goldsmith score, which makes it kind of sort of worth the money. The quality of the presentation is, I would say it's good. I'm not going to say it's, as you say, demonstrably better than the DVD, but there are some scenes in it when you can tell a little bit of a difference, and it's for me it was worth it. I mean, because I'm such a fan of The Other, I just think it's a terrific, terrific movie, and I just wanted to have that in high definition, and I got really giddy when they released it. So, so there's but anyway, a couple other things here, and we'll finish up with the classic releases. We have a couple more Altman films that are coming out via Kino. They're putting out The Long Goodbye and Thieves Like Us. So those two are,
those are great.
Yeah, they really are, and I'm glad they're issuing those. Shockwave.
Yeah, I've got The Long Goodbye on the region, whatever it is, the region A or region B or whatever.
Yeah,
it's not,
yeah.
So I can't play it because I don't have a region free player. So that's been frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
I love The Long Goodbye. It's one of my all-time favorite Altman films. And
yeah, likewise.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Shockwaves is a film that I saw when I was a kid. I must have been about 7.
Oh, yeah,
got
Peter
that.
Cushing doesn't even show up. They kept saying on the TV, oh, Peter Cushing, he doesn't show up till the very end. I mean,
yeah.
Well, anyway, at any rate, it is going to be issued by Blue Underground. And then we have Don't Be a Menace to South Central While Drinking Your Juice in the Hood from Lionsgate. So there you go. So that takes care of the classic releases for November. If you guys want to run over a couple of these, the more recent films that are coming out, we have Nymphomaniac Volumes 1 and 2 in an extended director's cut in one disc. So not sure.
Okay.
So we have
well,
that one.
Well, that's cool that they did it all in one disc.
Yeah.
So it
yeah,
becomes one movie now. So.
You have the one of the final Robin Williams films, Merry Friggin' Christmas, which I have not had time to look at, although it did
have it. Yeah.
I'm curious about that. We have The November Man, Tyler Perry's A Medea Christmas, and The Expendables 3 and The Giver. So those are a couple of...
The Giver. Wow, that came out quick.
Yeah.
Both and Expendables 3. That's out there both. Well, they have to try to make the money back any way they can with that movie.
Yeah.
But
Expendables 3 was the flop of the year.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
Right.
Is it really? I mean, like, it's the biggest money loser, or really?
Yeah.
Well, how much did it cost to make?
Well, I would imagine that it did probably only cost probably in the $50 to $60 million range, but it also, you know, before it even came out, it lost that amount of money by people paying.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So, 22 Jump Street is coming. That's coming soon.
It's already
out. Actually,
I watched that this weekend. Not nearly as funny for me as the first one, but it did have some
totally
clever stuff in it. But yeah,
it has some very funny things in it, though. I mean, it's got some very funny things in it.
Well,
okay.
Sin City, A Dame to Kill For. I'm not sure anybody's clamoring for that, but
can I ask a question? Wouldn't that be the big that and 300 be the big duds of the year? Though, I mean, Sin City is a wretchedly bad film, and I don't think it made that much money.
It did not do well.
I mean, we're talking about money losers, not quality, and money losers in relation to budget. I mean, Rodriguez always keeps his budgets low.
That's true.
So there's minimal downside.
That, though, this is still a disaster. I mean, I don't think this movie lasted that long in the theaters at all. I mean,
another big bomb this year, wasn't that Adam Sandler movie, like, pretty huge?
Mm-hmm. Blended,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that would be a big...
Yeah. Well, we got a couple of August releases that are making their way to... Well, they already have. They've already been released. If I Stay and Into the Storm... Those are both have been issued, and Tammy, the Melissa McCarthy film. So, you know, what more needs to be said about that? I'm not sure. Let's Be Cops and Jersey Boys. Those are
Is a lot better than I said it.
And both of these movies that you mentioned are actually, you know, made money. I mean, Let's Be Cops made a lot of money, and Jersey Boys made money. I mean, these are not, you know, they went under the radar, but they actually made some money.
Yep, that's true. Most Wanted Man, the Philip Seymour Hoffman, Most Wanted Man, that's coming, is already out, I'm sorry. And Hercules, the one with Dwayne Johnson. That's out now. There is an extended version of The Desolation of Smaug, The Hobbit. Just what we need. So, anyway, in anticipation, just another way to milk milk the money.
Because I know that everyone was watching The Hobbit movies thinking, God, if only these could be longer.
By the way, here's a question. Do you think that now that Peter Jackson will go and do three movies of The Silmarillion?
I hope not. I really hope not.
If he can, he probably will. That's my guess.
I bet he will.
Yeah, if he thinks he can get away with it, he will. I'm sure. Anyway, I've got an advanced screening of that new Hobbit next week, I think. The week, not this week, but the coming week, and I'm not really anticipating that. I guess I'll slog through it. I'll grudgingly go. They'll take me kicking and screaming all the way, but anyway.
How long is it? What is it, 3.5 hours long?
God, I don't even know. I'm afraid.
No, it is. But remember, this movie is going to make even more money than the others. Because this is where the Force Awakens teaser trailer is going to appear, it seems. So this movie will make that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this movie is the highest grossing movie of the year.
We're going to see that. But, you know, that teaser trailer is going to be online like the minute that it hits.
They will be eventually on, but I think they're going to make sure the only way you can see it, at least that first week, is on the movie.
So this
okay.
will be like
I mean,
Joe Black will
yeah.
make a lot more money than it should.
That thing's going to – I remember they when The Phantom Menace came out, and they played the preview on, I think, a movie that wasn't all that. Like, they were trying to help out the movie by putting the teaser on it.
Well,
it was on Meet Joe Black.
Well,
that could be it. I mean, yeah.
And then
but,
the other trailer was in front of Wing Commander.
Yeah, that's it.
yeah.
Yeah.
Well – two more releases, newer films, and this will be it. Step Up, All In, and Maleficent. Those are both, they're out now. So that
is it me, or does Maleficent have, like, enough, feels like that movie got enough good notices to check out. Like, am I wrong there? Was that just
no,
a,
it's actually a very good movie, and I think it's also the highest grossing movie, of, if I'm not mistaken, of Angelina Jolie's career, or the biggest
okay.
opening. So,
I think I need to check that movie out because it looks like it's really well produced. So I think I'm going to make the effort.
And Step Up All In is actually a recreation of what it's like to date Brigitte Nielsen. So it's the best one to check out.
Well, that is the Blu-ray report, actually. So that pretty much takes us up to December, and you know, there's some interesting things. And in anticipation, this is the one that's coming out in a couple of months. I'm really excited about. Criterion announced their February slate, and they're going to be issuing "Don't Look Now," which I am
yes
about.
Oh,
yeah,
yes.
So
good one.
Our good friend Bobby Osteen actually flew to Paris to interview the editor of that film. For that Criterion Blu-ray. So that's one of the editors on the Blu-ray. Yeah.
Wasn't that Graham Clifford, I believe? I think it is.
That's
the guy who directed Francis later on.
You're right,
yeah.
Right.
Wow.
And that movie is particularly stunning for its editing, Don't Look Now. I mean, just...
Oh,
it
God,
is.
Yeah.
Editing and photography, both.
Yeah.
Well, funny story,
and
it was...
Sutherland Schlong.
Oh, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I mean, all of it's just brilliant.
It is. It's a funny story because back before we had VCRs, you know, in the mid 80s, before we got one in our house, I wanted to see Don't Look Now so badly that I set my alarm clock, because it was only on in the middle of the night. I set my alarm clock so I could get up in the middle of the night and actually physically watch the film, because I have any way to tape it. And I remember sitting there at 2:45 in the morning, and it ended almost like 4 o'clock or something. I was just stunned after I had seen it.
Was this on cable, or was it
Yeah,
on...
it was on cable. It was on cable.
Okay, so you saw it uncut, huh?
Yeah, I saw it uncut, and I sat there, and I was probably 18 or 19 years old around the time, and I was younger. It was about 14, 15, I guess. And even then, I was stunned. I mean, it was just, you know, a stunning experience. Of course, it's even grown for me over the years. I read more into it as the years go on and I get older. But even then, it was just like, wow. And that DiNaggio score and just, oh,
yeah.
Man. Just incredible.
And those incredible, you know, the incredible shots of Venice and so forth in it.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Definitely.
And,
so anyway.
And great opening. Too. Just a,
yes.
a great opening to the film. It's superb.
Yeah. So, anyway, just a teaser for the February Criterion slate, and I guess that's it.
I mean, Venice looks beautiful in it. I wonder, that's not what you call like a movie that you'd use to attract tourism in the area. Even though Venice looks beautiful as well. That's what I have in store for me? Oh, shit.
I think if you wanted to go to Venice, you would take a look at David Lean's Summertime first, and then one of my favorite movies, A Little Romance. And also, there's a Bond movie that takes place in Venice, doesn't it? Or at least part of it.
Moonraker.
Yeah, that. But isn't there one like earlier, too? Like
From Russia
one of the
60s. I'm not missing.
By the way,
the ending.
Moonraker isn't a good tourist attraction for the moon either. I mean,
or space in general.
Man, if I really could colonize the moon after watching Moonraker, I'd be all pumped up for that. All right, Adam, thank you, buddy. I appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I enjoyed it as
always.
Yeah,
thanks.
Guys.
Always get really good conversations out of these
overviews, so never know what's going to pop up.
No, we don't. It's potluck for sure. That's you never
oh,
can
by,
tell.
By the way, Adam, tell me one more time. Who stars in that More Dead Than Alive?
More Dead Than Alive. I think that's Vincent Price and Clint Walker. We'll be right back.